I would, for those of you who haven't looked at the program today, the topic of our discussion today is going to be the conflict between the German Jews and the Eastern European Jewish immigrants. Okay, thank you. Eastern European Jewish immigrants between 1880 and 1910. That's the topic of our discussion today. And before I begin our discussion, I would like to paint for you, and I'll wait. Come on. There's sources over there. Before I begin our discussion today, I would like to paint an image for you. 1882. They sit on either side of a long table. The old man fixes his eyes on the strange woman by the window. What he sees is alien to him, reminding him of a picture he once saw in the shtetl. In it, the wives of Russian aristocrats surrounded the princess in the courts of St. Petersburg. This woman is obviously not a Russian aristocrat, but she is dressed like one. In a suit of rich velvet with diamonds dangling from her ears, she sits proudly erect in a polished oak chair. Behind her is a window through which the confused man can see the ominous skyscrapers of New York City. From her oak chair, the bejeweled woman stares at the man across the table. What she sees evokes both disgust and sympathy. The man is dressed in a long and dirty black kaftan. His beard is unkempt, and he has forgotten to remove his hat. The maze of wrinkles upon his thin and tired face seem more the product of hardship than of age. Uncomfortable at the prolonged silence, the woman breaks it with a question. "When did you arrive?" she asks in perfect English. "Ich verstehe nicht," answers the man in Yiddish, his nervousness apparent. Their eyes lock. Two Jews from different worlds, yet Jews nonetheless. In the same split second, a question races through each one's mind. Can this man become an American? Can this woman be a Jew? This fictional account of a rendezvous between a German Jewish American and an Eastern European immigrant in the late 19th century really summarizes the topic that we're going to discuss today. The conflict that arose between these two groups, between the 1880s and the early 1900s, was one that was characterized by ambivalence on both sides. The conflict itself was marked by tensions between similarity and difference, sympathy and hostility, responsibility and disassociation, and gratitude and resentment. The German Jews who had come to America in the mid-century, and that is, we'll talk more about the 1830s and 1840s, resented the influx of Eastern European Jewish immigrants in the late 1800s. But they also felt a responsibility towards them, a responsibility to both help them and to Americanize them. We'll talk a lot about that. The Eastern European Jew was thoroughly perplexed, as we saw in that fictional account just now, by this Americanized Jew that they encountered. And they felt a myriad of different emotions when they encountered these Americanized Jews. They felt awe at the success that these Jews had attained. They felt gratitude for the charity that these Jews were affording them. And they also felt resentment for the patronizing way in which this charity was often given them, and for the obvious attempt by the German Jews to change the traditions and the culture of the Eastern European Jewish immigrants. Now, this conflict played itself out in many different areas. And in the short time we have today, we're going to try and shed some light on some of these areas by looking at primary sources, which, as you know, is the best way to study history. And luckily for me, many of these sources are now available online, as opposed to going to look at microfilm in various large libraries all over the country, which is when I first researched this topic, what I had to do. And now I was so happy to see that some of these newspapers, although there were some that I couldn't find, are available online. And this conflict plays itself out in on religious level, political level, economic level, and cultural level. So we're going to take some time to look at each of these areas, although we won't spend too much time on the economic areas of this conflict, although I'll maybe touch on it for a minute or two. And we're going to look at these sources together to see what they say about this conflict between these two groups. But before we do that, as in most history discussions and lectures, we need to have some historical background. And we need this historical background in two different areas. And the first thing we have to understand is, what was the historical milieu in terms of American culture in general in the late 1800s? What were sort of the prevalent values and the popular ideas in America in that time period? And in fact, if you look at that time period, you probably are all familiar with the metaphor of the melting pot. Right? You all have heard of that idea, that sort of the ideal American was one that came with all these different ethnic distinctions and then was sort of melted together into this large cauldron. You know, this was originally a play by Israel Zangwill, and there's this image of this large cauldron of all of these people being melted together to create this ideal American who doesn't have all these ethnic distinctions. And this was really the ideal in the late 1800s of conformity, right, of this melting pot. And of course, as you can imagine, with conformity comes other things like racism, like anti-Semitism, like xenophobia, this fear of strangers, this fear of strangeness. And we need to understand this and keep this in mind when we evaluate the reaction of the German Jews to this influx of Eastern European immigrants, right? Because here they are living in a time where conformity was valued, right? And all of a sudden these fellow Jews come in, right? All very primitive to them, okay? Very strange. And this strangeness was an affront to this value of conformity. The German Jews wanted so badly to maintain their power to create the image of the American Jew for the American public, right? So up until this time, right, who is creating this image? It's the German Jews in America, right? They're able to make sure that the American public has a certain vision of what the American Jew should be. All of a sudden, you have millions, right?
What percentage are the German Jews of the American community?
If you give me one more second, I'm going to give you some statistics, okay, so you have a sense. I don't know if I know percentages, but I can give you numbers, okay? Definitely a majority. I know, I think by 1850, more than half of New York's Jews were German Jews. You still had a Sephardic population, which I'll talk about in a second. But the German Jews really felt that they wanted to maintain control over who set the image of the American Jew in the collective American mind. And because of that, they are hawkishly attentive to how Americans see the image of the Jew. So they are going to be terrified when they see, for instance, a headline, and we're going to look at some of those headlines, that talk about these European immigrants as radicals and things of that nature. They are hawkishly attentive to how the Americans are looking at this image of the Jew. But what do they decide to do? Okay, how are they going to address these problems and this fear? They decide that they are not going to disassociate themselves. Because if you think about it, if you know a little bit about the history of the Jews in Germany, let's say post-emancipation, right, or post French Revolution, you know that there was also an influx of Eastern European Jews into Germany. And the way that those German Jews related to those Eastern European Jews, if you've heard the term Ostjuden, okay, that was a pejorative term that meant Eastern Jews, and they very often disassociated themselves. They wanted nothing to do with those Eastern Jews. This is something different. How are we going to shape the image? Well, let's not disassociate ourselves from these new immigrants. Let's change them. Let's make them conform. Let's Americanize them. Let's assimilate them into American culture. And then we will maintain this control over the image of the Jew. I want you to look for one second now at the cover of your source sheet, which has a couple interesting things on it. I'm not going to so much talk about the Shana Tova card, which we can talk about later. But look at the bottom of that, okay? You're probably all familiar with what you see there. And that is, as you guessed, it is a translation of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States of America in both Yiddish and Hebrew. And by the way, note that it doesn't say Yiddish. You see what it says there?
Jewish German.
Okay, they were very wary of saying the word Yiddish, right? That was sort of a pejorative term. They didn't like the fact that Yiddish to them was a primitive language, so they sort of changed it a little. They know they have to translate it into the language of the people, but they call it Jewish German. And this was a pamphlet that was often handed out to immigrants right when they came. Why? Okay, the idea is that what's the crucial foundation of becoming an American citizen, of patriotism, right?
Citizenship,
right? And what do you have to know in order to be a citizen? You have to appreciate the foundations of this country, right? You have to appreciate the religious freedom that's afforded to us by the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And how will you do that if you don't speak English? Aha, the first thing we're going to do, we're going to translate these things and hand them out to the immigrants. So this was the approach that you're going to see that the German Jews decide to take. But it's, again, one of ambivalence, because on the one hand, they're trying to help these people in their minds, and the other hand, they're really trying to get rid of a lot of what makes them distinct and their ethnic and religious cultural differences. Okay. Also, while we are... actually, turn to the first page of your source sheet for a minute. Okay, and this is a very interesting source. We're going to just read, first, for now, the first paragraph of a excerpt from the American Israelite. So I have to tell you a little bit about the American Israelite for a second, and I'm going to get to the population thing in a minute. The American Israelite was a periodical, was a newspaper that was published in Cincinnati. Now, Cincinnati, although it's a very small Jewish community now, was a major Jewish community before the influx of Eastern European Jews in terms of German-Jewish community. And you probably all know Hebrew Union College. Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise was founded in Cincinnati. And this was kind of the arm or the voice of the Reform movement in some ways, but it was also a regular newspaper. And in fact, I didn't know this, it's still published today. The American Israelite is the longest published American Jewish newspaper in this country. It comes out of Cincinnati.
So it didn't stop in 2000?
No, it did not stop. It must be where I took it from the source areas must only have the archives till 2000, and now because I got the archives from the actual website, so that's probably why it says till 2000. And this newspaper was instrumental in helping American Jews all over the country remain aware of things going on within the American Jewish community. So a lot of, when historians study this period, a lot of times they'll stick to the periodicals or the newspapers from New York, because that's where most of the Jews were living. And this is an interesting source because it's coming out of Cincinnati, and actually I saw when I was looking through the archives, it has like paragraphs on things going on in very different cities in the South and the West and things like that. Because remember, German Americans actually moved into the interior of the country. So look what this says. Follow along with me from the top. The civilization of those immigrants is in form entirely different from ours. Will they become good citizens of this country? They must become that, or we will have no use for them. Will they adopt American culture in the spirit of our country and century? Unless they do that, they will disturb our social status and may do considerable damage to the good reputation of our co-religionists. Liberty works miracles in the transformation of character, and the Jew, especially, cannot long resist the influences coming from the people around him. Still, we consider it our duty to call the special attention of all philanthropists engaged in assisting those Russian strangers to insist especially upon those points that all minors be sent to the public schools. Whether they know or do not know the English language, let the minors be Americanized as fast as possible. So right away, we see what is the answer to this fear, what is the answer to this problem that they're going to have? Americanization. Send the kids to the public schools. We have to stop this problem before it starts, before it damages the image of the American Jew. The second part of the historical context that we need to be familiar with before embarking on the analysis of some of these sources is what you asked before, how and when did these groups of Jews come to America? Okay, so a few statistics. In 1800, there were 2,000 American Jews. Okay, 1848, 50,000 Jews in America. 1880, 250,000. And by 1914, there were over 3 million Jews in this country. So here you take a very short period of time, right? And you see, I don't even know how many times the population, multiplied itself 100 by 100%. But in a very short, relatively short period of time.
What? Can you go through it again?
Yeah, sorry. So let's say 1800, there were 2,000 Jews.
Yes.
1848, 50,000. That's after the influx of German Jews, right, from in the 30s and 40s. 1880, at the beginning of the real influx of Eastern Europeans, there were a quarter of a million, 250,000, and by 1914, there were over 3 million on the eve of World War I, over 3 million Jews. Okay, so why did these numbers change so drastically? As some of you probably remember from history classes, the first group of American Jews to come, even in the late 1600s, early 1700s, were of Spanish-Portuguese origin. And then even within, as those Jews were sort of set the tone, and they were the majority for a long time, but even within that, it's not fair to say those were the only Jews. You still had some German Jews coming and some even Eastern European Jews coming, but they sort of set the tone. It was kind of, that was the, even if it wasn't always the numeric majority, it set the tone of the American Jew was a Sephardic tone, okay? By the 1830s and 40s, because of things that were happening in Europe, many German Jews began to enter into the United States. You had economic depression, you had a rise in anti-Semitism, you had failed revolutions, and popular to what most people believe, a lot of these German Jews, because they moved up the ladder so fast, were actually poor and uneducated. Many of these German Jews became peddlers. Now, in popular culture, can anyone think in like movies or books or anything, kind of the icon of the German peddler, German Jewish peddler? And I'll mention, this may give you a hint, whereas the Eastern European immigration mostly stayed in the eastern seaboard and the large cities in the eastern seaboard and then maybe moved into other large cities, the German influx, the German immigration in the 1830s and 40s were encouraged to move into the western states and the southern states. That's why, in some of these really small little southern and western towns, you always had the general store was owned by a Jew, and this was a German Jew, usually, or the only lawyer in town, or the only doctor in town, in these small towns. I know we were in Colorado. What?
Levi. California.
Yeah, so it's very interesting.
We lived in Greensboro for the last 2 years, mm-hmm. and Greensboro is a very Jewish town. The Moses Cohen did the one of the jeans, the denim companies.
Right, and it dates itself back to the mid-19th century is when most of these communities were established.
Did not expect to have so much Jewish history in this.
Right. And it's funny, the Jewish history that you can find in some of these towns where now there's no Jewish community, but for some, they have a plaque on a building that says there was a shul there in 1830s and 1840s. I was thinking when I was looking this over of Oklahoma. You know the musical Oklahoma? You know, they don't actually explicitly say the peddler is Jewish, mm-hmm. but he has a German accent, and clearly here he went out, right, to be the peddler with the push cart in Oklahoma. That was what I was thinking of. So these Jews quickly established themselves and actually sort of climbed the ladder of success pretty quickly. And then we come to our discussion today, which focuses on the immigration of the Eastern European Jews beginning in approximately 1881. And probably many of you are familiar with the horrible rise of anti-Semitism in Russia and Eastern Europe in that time period. Probably, I usually ask my Jewish history students how many of you know where your families came from or know when they came, and many of them say, oh, I think my parents, they go back and ask, and they came in 1902, or they came in 1904, or they came in 1882, because those are the few years where most, where the largest numbers of people came because of the pogroms, right? The assassination of Tsar Alexander II sparked one of the major influxes of Eastern European immigrants in 1881. And then the other thing that we can't discount is industrialization in Europe, which because of the huge population explosion, Europe couldn't support the numbers, right, of people and new children that were being born. And so people begin to naturally try and find other places to live. And the last thing, really, that pushed this immigration was that once you start having Jewish communities establish themselves of like-minded people with the same culture from the same shtetl or the neighboring shtetl, well, guess what happens? They write letters home, right? And that relatives start talking to each other. And you all know the stories of, like, the father coming and sending back for the rest of the family, and then other people in the shtetl here, they all went to this place called Chicago, and then other people start coming. So word of mouth also contributed to the Jews all kind of at once wanting to get out and come to the United States. Of course, lucky for them, the doors were still open, right? Unfortunately, you all know.
At that time, many in the 1880s, many went to Israel, the Harutzim.
Right. I don't know, not many in comparison with the numbers we're talking about, unfortunately, right? But yes, exactly. So again, they were looking for places to settle, and those were definitely some of the choices. And again, America had open immigration policy. Unfortunately for us, those policies changed on the eve of World War II, which is why so many Jews could not find refuge in the United States. So with this in mind, with all this historical context in mind, we can now begin to look at some of the sources and what they reveal about this conflict between these two groups in this time period. So if you turn to, again, page one, okay, we're going to talk a little bit about the religious conflicts, which is going to be very interesting, I think, to all of us. And I will tell you for a second that it's ironic. All these things are a little bit ironic. Because when the German Jews, and we're not going to look at any of these sources, but when the German Jews first came in the 1830s and 1840s, there is a lot of evidence that they complained about the laxity in religious practice of the Sephardic Jews, right? And now we have in the 1880s and early 1900s, the German Jews, right, who have become very American and who have become very modern, and of course the reform movement is growing by leaps and bounds, mostly fueled by German Jewish leaders and things of that nature, and the Eastern European Jews are going to come and complain about the laxity of the German Jews, okay? And that also, unfortunately, changes pretty quickly, because then you have a lot of, loss of religious tradition on the part of the next generation of Eastern European Jews. So, these things all change as time passes. Now, if you look at the second paragraph where I have some things highlighted there, right? How are the German Jews going to address this fundamental difference in religious practice and religious observance, right? So the German Jews are very focused on having a non-primitive religion, right? Reform Judaism, later the Pittsburgh Platform in 1885 focuses itself on these tenets of modernization and getting rid of these primitive traditions and things like that. That's a whole famous story about the Pittsburgh Platform, and that's sort of what kind of pushed the conservative movement to begin in 1885. But the German Jews are very offended by the extreme religiosity of many of these immigrants, and not to say that everybody was, but even if they weren't religious, they many of them respected the traditions. And they looked very religious, and they had pious, and they looked a certain way, and the German Jews thought, how do we address this? So interestingly enough, take a look at the highlighted section, I say there was and is another agent at work, one that usually receives, I'm going to run out of time, the least credit for its influence, and that is the enlightened rabbi who prompts and reforms from within. I'm going to skip a little bit to where to three dots. It says, if those Russian immigrants will build among us that demi-Asiatic Hasidism and medieval orthodoxy to any considerable extent, together with a lack of modern learning and culture, they will become a cancer on the body of Judaism, which will fast enough consume the best blood of our social organism. So they are so afraid of this primitivism, okay, and this medieval orthodoxy. What do they decide to do, right? They're not going to disassociate themselves from these Jews. What do they say? And the article goes on, but I didn't include the whole thing. They have to create modern rabbis who speak Yiddish, who could go into these communities, right, and modernize from within. And in fact, the article goes on to say, let's raise money and pay to send Eastern European students to Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. We'll train them as reform rabbis, they'll go back into the community, and they'll solve our problem. They'll modernize from within. How do you think the Eastern European immigrants feel about this, this approach, which on the one hand is in the German Jewish mind, is trying to help them, and the other hand is very patronizing and offensive, that they're trying to get rid of their, you know, what's so important to them. It's so much a part of their lives. And I have an interesting source, in source number two, a man named Hutchins Hapgood, who was a non-Jewish journalist, actually studied the ghetto in New York, actually in the Lower East Side. And if you look, and I just have the front of his book here because it was kind of an interesting, I think it's out of print. I could only find pictures of it on the internet, and I couldn't find the book itself. But I was able to look at it on the internet. If you turn to page 3, and you see the underlined part, right? He's talking about how the Eastern European immigrants feel about these new rabbis in seeing how they characterize them in Yiddish theater. So he says, then again, some mere adventurers get into the position, men good for nothing looking for a position. They clap a high hat on their heads, impose on a poor congregation with their up-to-dateness, and become rabbis without learning or piety. These fake rabbis for business only, are often satirized in the Yiddish plays given at the Bowery theaters. On the stage, they are ridiculous figures, ape American manners in bad accents, and have a keen eye for gain. So he's talking about how these rabbis, so-called rabbis, who are the modern rabbis who maybe studied, you know, maybe studied at Hebrew Union College, not to offend Hebrew Union College, but put the top hat on and look, you know, have been trained by, right, official, and look, have been trained by the German Jewish authorities and rabbinic authorities, and how the community looks at them, they're sort of a mockery, okay? And it's interesting to hear that sort of from an outside perspective, not necessarily a Jewish perspective. The next source, I may just summarize this, but is also an interesting one. It's actually from this time an Eastern European Orthodox rabbi, who is speaking at a place called the Educational Alliance, which began as a settlement house on the Lower East Side, built by German Jews, right? To educate, to reform the Eastern European immigrants, but also to help them. Again, you see that ambivalence. And they allow this rabbi to give sermons on Shabbat, presumably. And he gives the sermon, and I find the irony here very interesting, because here he's in the Educational Alliance, which the German Jews are funding for the purpose of Americanizing, but he's giving a sermon which is basically criticizing and chastising the modernity of the American of the German American. So what does he say? I won't read this whole thing, but he basically gives a sermon about Joseph. That's his parallel, right? And he says when with the family in Canaan, Joseph's brothers were forced to come to Egypt in search of food. Okay, so there we have the parallel, right? The Eastern Europeans coming to this country. Joseph is like the German Jews, bringing them in to give them food. And he says here the parallel ended. And the lesson began. Joseph was not ashamed of his ancestry, right? I'm talking about Yosef in the Tanakh. He was not guided by contempt for his brother's poverty and strange culture. And he says, I am your brother Joseph. We are members of the same nation and religion, and I am proud to assist you in your time of need. Okay, and here he's chastising these German-American Jews, right? He's saying, look, we came here now, right? We were starving, and you brought us here, and you're providing for us, but you are not connecting with us. You are not treating us as if we are your brethren, okay? Unlike Joseph. So I find this a little bit ironic that that's what he's talking about in this educational alliance, which is provided for them as a way of Americanizing the Eastern European Jews. I'm going to skip source number 4. Just know that there's a lot of Yiddish poetry and Hebrew poetry which brings up these themes of the Eastern Europeans very disappointed and disheartened by the very Americanized and secularized German Jews. But I'm going to skip that one. The next conflict, which I think to be one of the most interesting, or the next realm where we see this conflict, is the political realm. Okay, and for this, I was able to find a lot of interesting sources in different newspapers that you can access online. And this conflict that we're talking about reached a certain ferocity in the political realm. Why? Why is that the case? Does anybody know anything about the 1880s and 90s in America, politically speaking? Okay, exactly, right? So we have the beginning of labor unions, right? So what was going on? There's no protection of workers, right? We have the beginning of, industrialization is in full force. We have factories. There's no child labor laws. There's no protection. There's no eight-hour rules about, how long you can work. Workers are exploited right and left. Work conditions are dangerous. People are killed every day by new machinery that they have no idea how to, how to protect workers. And because of this, workers are agitating for rights, right? They strike all the time, right? We all remember a little bit of this from American history. And of course, who is associated with a lot of this radicalization? The Jews, okay? And American culture in general and American society is terrified of what they call anarchy, right? This hatred of organized government, of radicals, right? And everywhere you look in the papers of the time, people are hugely anti-radical, okay? And of course, the German Jews, oh my God, right? Who is associating now with these radicals? It's the Jews coming from Russia, especially, right, where you have the beginnings of, socialism and communism, things like that. And the Jews now who are, of course, the bulk, let's say, of the garment workers, let's say, in the garment industry in New York City, right, are Eastern European immigrants who are treated so poorly, and they're gathering together and beginning to try and change things. And the German Jews are beside themselves. They're often the bosses, by the way, right? Some of the leading industrialists and leading people in the retail industry. You can name some of them yourself. I made a list before. I don't even know where I put it, but like Strauss and Bloomingdale and all these retail industries are starting at this time. And I gave you an example in source number 5. Here's a very good example. New York Times article, 1895. Many tailors on strike, right? Americans were reading this and they were aghast. And of course, if you look, this is the great strike threatened by the Brotherhood of Tailors. The second column, take a look at the top two lines. It says, we're on page 4. Okay. The General Executive Board is composed as follows. Meyer Schoenfeld of New York, General Organizer. And then in the last paragraph again, Meyer Schoenfeld is regarded as the manager of the Brotherhood. Right. So here you have a Jewish name, and you have countless articles like this that talk about the Jews who are at the forefront of this labor movement and these strikes and things like that. And the German Jewish community feels that they are losing this ability to shape the image of the Jew, as the Jew is equated with radicalism. Another, and I want to get back to this in one second, but if you turn to page 5, another political movement that is terrifying, this might be surprising to you, that is terrifying, the German Jewish establishment, is political Zionism, right? Which, of course, is gaining followers and, becoming much more important in the late 1800s. Why do you think Zionism would feel as like such a threat to the German Jews in America?
Anybody? Not loyal to the United States.
Exactly, right? It shows a lack of loyalty to the United States. And you can see in source number 6, the Jewish American was a periodical, a newspaper in Detroit. There was a seminal work written by somebody about the Detroit Jewish community, and this is from that German Jewish Detroit newspaper, because this was also the leaders in Detroit at that time were German Jews. And they say, 1901, first, America, not Palestine, is the Jewish land of destiny, and Washington, not Jerusalem, is our national capital. And again, in 1904, Zionism is a political impossibility tantamount to treason, okay? The German Jews are threatened by this. It goes against everything all the pride they feel about our country, about America, right? And what it has given the German Jews in terms of the ability to be successful and the ability to have religious freedom and all of those things, to them is threatened by the idea that we should aspire to go somewhere else.
The Golden Medina is here.
Exactly. The Golden Medina, right, is here. Okay, exactly. So German Jews were very threatened by this, and of course some of the leading Zionists in America, most of them, were of course Eastern European immigrants, right, who had also, studied these ideas and been in a very, an area in Eastern Europe where there were many Yiddish writers and Hebrew writers who were the first ones to write about the beginnings of political Zionism. Now, source number 7 you're going to find extra interesting. Before you look at what I have written on page 5, take a look at page 5A. It's the next page. You'll see the front page of the Chicago Daily Tribune. Everyone take a look at that? And here you have an interesting headline. It says, anarchistic assassin killed by Chief Shippy and weapons with which he is armed. And on the left, you'll see extra, right? Would-be slayer, a Russian Red. And if you continue down, it describes who the assassin is, and that I reprinted on page 5 if you can't read it because it's a little hard to see. It says, who is the assassin who has killed this Chief Shippy? I'm going to tell you the details of this in a minute. His name is Lazarus Averbush. He is 20 years old, nationality Russian Jew. This is the front page of the Chicago Daily Tribune in 1908. Okay, this is the talk of the country in 1908. Okay, this is everybody in the country is talking about this assassination. What happened? Here was a newly arrived Eastern Russian Jew. He had been in the country for 3 months. And he shows up at the door of the police chief in Chicago, whose name was Chief Shippy. He's a police commissioner. And the police commissioner happens to be a fierce anti-radical. His mission in life is to get rid of any radical threats in Chicago. And this man, Averbush, who's 20 years old, shows up at his door and he has a letter in his hand. Okay? No one really knows exactly what happened after that. Because, we only have the testimony of Shippy. Because 10 minutes later, Laser Averbush was dead with a bullet wound to his head. Now, Shippy, Chief Shippy, says in his testimony that Laser was an anarchist and had come to assassinate him, to murder him. And he says that he knew right away that Laser was up to no good because of, and I quote, the foreign cast of features that he saw when he looked at Laser Averbush. And Shippy grabs him, this is what Shippy says, and finds that he has a gun, and a fight ensues, and Laser ends up dead on the ground. Of course, there's huge holes in his testimony. The gun was never found. Guess what the note said? The note that seemed to have been at the heart of this had Shippy's address on it and the price of a dozen eggs. Okay? And that is the evidence that the only evidence is Shippy's testimony. The mainstream papers in America have a field day with this. Here is a newly arrived Russian Jew who has come and tried to murder the police chief in Chicago and totally ignore the inconsistencies of the case. They paint him as a nefarious radical. Everyone believes it. People even, they say, the papers, Chicago papers say that people came to see the degenerate face of this radical. And in fact, that's the picture you have on page 5. How sad is this, by the way? Talk about desecration of the dead. This is them holding him, holding his face up for the newspapers to show the American people what this nefarious Jewish immigrant radical would have looked like. And next to this picture in other places, they have the picture of Chief Shippy's son. Note the contrast, right? Chief Shippy's handsome son sitting there because apparently he was also involved in this and corroborated his father's testimony. And you see the difference here, right? Well, what do the Jewish papers, if you turn the page now to page 6, what do the Jewish papers have to say this? I don't have reprinted any Eastern European papers, but the Yiddish papers were furious. They poked all the holes that could be poked in this case and said this has been he's been framed, you know, and they really tried to say, you know, what's going on here? This doesn't hold up. The Record Herald, which was a regular Chicago newspaper, just to give you another idea, said the greater proportion of anarchists are Russian Jews, and these are said to have had the doctrine of death to all officials ground into them ever since infancy. And the American Israelite in Source 9 on March 5, 1908, weighs in on this topic. And what do they say? Remember, this is the German Jewish newspaper that's sort of the voice of the Reform Movement and coming out of Cincinnati, but again, read by many of the Jews in this country, maybe not the New York Jews. And what do they say? I'm going to try and read this a little quickly because it's so interesting. That Averbush is of Jewish parentage has yet to be proven. When the first reports, I'm on page 6 if everyone sees that, when the first reports of President McKinley's assassination were sent out, it was stated positively in them that his murderer was a Russian Jew. That was in 1901. It was subsequently learned that he was in reality a Roman Catholic. Nevertheless, for some time, we were obliged to bear the odium of the dastardly deed. It may be so in this case. Let us hope that this will turn out to be a similar error. Whether Averbush was a Jew or not, whether he planned his crime alone and had accomplices, the Chicago authorities will do the country in general and those of the Jewish faith more particularly a service, whose value will be hard to overestimate if they will bring about the deportation, imprisonment for long terms, or even hanging of the whole scroungerly lot, whatever stock they may be descended from. The Jews of the whole country deplore more keenly than any other class of their countrymen that so foul a deed should have been done and that its perpetrator should possibly have been one who would be considered one of them. Okay? This is the German Jewish Reform newspaper weighing in. You don't see any possibility of the fact that Chief Shippy was framing, right, Averbush, or just acted impulsively because he was anti-radical, that maybe this guy who looked foreign to him was suspicious, right, and shot him dead in his house. They do not allow for any of that, okay? So this gives you a sense of the attempt by the German Jewish community to distance themselves from this radicalization of the Eastern European immigrant, and why they felt even more strongly that they better, as much as possible, quickly educate these Jews and Americanize these Jews and assimilate these Jews into the wider American culture to keep this radicalism from spreading. Now, the cultural conflict is also an interesting one. We'll see how much time we have to go through this, but at the bottom of page 6, you have an interesting little excerpt from the Jews of Detroit, and even though it's the Jews of Detroit, he talks a little bit, Robert Rockaway, a historian, talks a little bit about what anybody would have seen walking in the streets of the Lower East Side, and he talks about strolling down Houston Street, okay? Now, only somebody who has New York parents would know that that's not Houston Street, but Houston Street. Anybody who spent time in on the Lower East Side as a child will know right away not to say Houston Street. So strolling down Houston Street on the Lower East Side, the bottom of page six, one was often pushed and shoved by the throngs of shoppers, nudged by the flailing gesticulations of a peddler making a bargain. The Yiddish language, in which there was a metaphorical expression to describe every shade of emotion, reflected the more passionate Eastern European personality. Obsessed with the public image of the Jew, these cultural flaws infuriated the German Jews. An article in the Jewish American asked, how could the Jews expect their non-Jewish neighbors to treat them as equals as long as they behaved like ghetto people? So again, we have this conflict playing itself out, even on a cultural level. The way these Jews looked, the way they dressed, the way even the more common, I don't want to say that everybody generalized, that everybody acted like this, but the common feeling when you walk through the Lower East Side was just as Robert Rockaway describes it. And this unnerved the German Jews. And again, they wanted so much to try and sort of change this culture so that it would be more palatable to the American public. I think I'm going to skip Source 11. Source 11, you can read it on your own, is from a work of fiction, American Jewish writer named Abraham Kahan, The Rise of David Levinsky, if you ever read it, was published in 1917. And he talks a little bit also about this sense of the Eastern European Jew, of himself landing on the shores, and being so perplexed when meeting sort of a wealthy German Jew and having the sense of ambivalence that, yes, I'm connected to this person, I feel some sort of kinship, I know he's Jewish, but he looks so different. He's wealthy, he has diamonds, he describes. And on the other hand, something we didn't talk about, he's also overcome with a sense of admiration in some ways, that this person has risen the level of success, and in some ways, he writes, right, is a living source of encouragement. And that's something also that Eastern European Jews, even with their resentment of how they were treated in a patronizing way, they also felt, hey, maybe we can be that one day. They've risen up that ladder of success, maybe we can do that as well. But I want to look now at the bottom of page 7, because now I really want to get into, in the last 10 minutes that we have, the ambivalence that we see in the charity campaign, right? Remember we said before, the German Jews are so fearful of the image of the Eastern European Jews, they want to help them, on the one hand, right? They want to embark on this charity campaign, right? But how do they do this? Okay, so take a look at the American Israelite in Source 12 in 1882. This is right at the beginning of the huge influx, right? And this is an editorial. What does this man say? On Thursday, 350 more arrived here to swell the little army of helpless men and women who came here deluded by the hope that their prosperous brethren in free America would extend them a helping hand. Ah, monsieur idealists, have not your dreams been rather rudely dispelled by the apathy displayed by the great bulk of our co-religionists? Here in the metropolis, he's writing from New York, for example, where Jewish millionaires can be counted by the dozen, it has so far been found impossible to raise the sum of $150,000 so that Emigrant Society can continue its work. To erect the gaudy Fifth Avenue Temple, $1 million was lavishly spent. To provide shelter, food, and raiment for 2,000 poor persecuted Russian Israelites, not one-tenth of that sum has been collected. So the assumption here, if this is an angry editorial by somebody from New York City, right, is that the idea of charity was considered a responsibility. The German Jews saw it as their responsibility to give charity, and yet here's this editorial saying we're not doing enough. So I want you to, even though, again, we see a lot of, a patronizing way of doing this and a sense that the motives were really to create this American Jew, right, still, they are truly trying to help and trying to give charity to aid these enormous numbers of immigrants. Now, source number 13 is interesting, especially from a woman's perspective. Women were very, very active in social reform in this time period. Some of you have heard of Lillian Wald, who started the Henry Street Settlement, right? And actually moved into the Lower East Side for 40 years because her sense was she could not help these people. She wasn't going to help them from the outside. She would help from the inside. And Jewish women, especially German Jewish women in this time period, were very active in trying to help the Eastern European Jews. But they did it in a very often condescending and patronizing tone. Minnie Lewis, whose voice is heard in these papers of the Jewish Women's Congress, and is an interesting source to look at, listen to what she says and tell me if you think this is empathy or whether she's being patronizing and condescending. "We must admit that with all our philosophy, we would deem the same circumstances for ourselves most extenuating. When there is no prospect of a day's work to furnish the wherewithal, when the father's coat, the feather pillows have all been pawned to still the hungry mouths, can we wonder that no ambition is aroused to keep the dismal apartment in proper condition?" Now, this is my favorite example of ambivalence here, right? In terms of how she's responding or reacting, right? So on the one hand, this is wonderful, right? They felt that, you know, it wasn't enough to have these educational programs. The women, the German Jewish women, felt they had to go into the neighborhoods, right? That was really where they were going to do their best work, right? They were going to go into the homes, and they were going to go into the neighborhoods of the Lower East Side, as difficult as that was for them, and help them. But look at these comments, right? It's a mix of empathy, because she says, look, if we were in that position, right, maybe the same circumstances, we would also be like this. But look how she says it, right? Can we wonder that no ambition is aroused, right? As if these people are sitting, right, on their whatevers, you know, doing nothing. They have no ambition to keep the dismal apartment in proper condition. So again, you see this real ambivalence and this mixture of feelings. And what we see is that the Eastern Europeans are going to react. You'll see that on the next page, but I want to just look at a source on page 8. If you turn, though, the page, you'll see it as one of the pages in the New York Times. On the left side, it says East Side Street Vendors. This is actually a page of the New York Times from 1893. This was an expose in the New York Times. So if you turn back to page 8, just listen to this for a minute. And the reason why I'm bringing this now is because even though we just saw how patronizing and how condescending some of this charity campaign was, you have to also keep in mind why the German Jews, and I said this before, were so nervous about the image of the Jew. If something like this could be in the New York Times in 1893, listen to what the writer wrote, okay? And this wasn't an editorial. This was somebody who they hired, you know, to write an expose. "In spite of the fact that the cheese was a reeking mass of rottenness and alive with worms, the long-whiskered descendants of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Judah would put their fingers in it and then suck them with great and evident relish. A writer might go on for a week reciting the abominations of these people and still have much to tell. This neighborhood, the Lower East Side, peopled almost entirely by the people who claim to have been driven from Poland and Russia, is the eyesore of New York and perhaps the filthiest place in the Western continent. They cannot be lifted up to a higher plane because they do not want to be." This is the New York Times in 1893. So what I want you to understand here is, as much as we can look at the German Jewish reaction and say, why were they so condescending, right? Couldn't they have just helped and said, you know, we have to understand this was the kind of anti-Semitic article you would commonly see in a publication like the New York Times in 1893. I'm going to try, I have 2 minutes to finish my last two sources. It's the last page. Source 15 is interesting because what is the Eastern European reaction to this sort of nice and helpful but very condescending charity campaign and educational efforts and social reform on the part of the German Jews? So often they felt gratitude, and you can, of course, find, you don't have all the sources here, you can find sources where they were very thankful, right? They had food on their table, they had somewhere to live, they often had jobs due to the German Jews, right? But they also, there was a lot of evidence of resentment. Right, they understood, they were intelligent people, that a lot of this effort had very different motivations than just helping. And interestingly, I picked a little excerpt here from a play. This is a Yiddish play in Source 15 by a man named Jacob Gordon. And as we all know, the Yiddish theater was so popular amongst the Eastern European immigrants. And this is an opening speech of a play called The Benefactors of the East Side. And it's a speech where they are parodying, right? It's a parody of the German Jewish leader, and this is what he's saying. So here he is, right? "Our great fellow citizen Lincoln raised the banner of freedom in the struggle of the slaves for liberation. We too are like Lincoln. Of course, the East Side population is not black, but they are Russians. And as such, they are not prepared to be good, loyal citizens. That's why it's so easy to propagandize all kinds of anarchistic theories among them. True, The persecutions made them schnorrers and beggars. But we too are human beings, and we must solve this great social problem in the name of truth, love, and in the name of humanity. Okay? What are they doing here with this satire, right? They're parodying, right? They're saying, you know, these German Jews who think that they are doing such great work, right? This is really how they're treating us. It's patronizing and it's very condescending. And to conclude, I just want to bring for you in Source 16 an interesting comment given in an interview with Louis Marshall. Louis Marshall was a very prominent German Jewish leader around the same time that we're talking about. He was a community leader. He was a lawyer. He actually founded the AJC, which is still around today, the American Jewish Congress. And he commented when asked about the source of the hostility between these two groups, having come from a certain perspective within the German Jewish community. And this is what he said. The German Jews held themselves aloof from the people. They did not associate with them socially, religiously, or otherwise. They acted as lords and ladies bountiful, bringing gifts to the people who did not seek for gifts. They frankly avowed the purpose of bettering those among whom they labored and of dealing with them as a problem. And the work was done in such a manner as not only to give offense, but to arouse suspicion of the motives which inspired the action contemplated. Marshall blames the approach of the German Jews as condescending, patronizing, and questions the motives of their charity. To German Jews, and I'm finishing up now, to German Jews, he's making me nervous, in America, this is my closing, okay, for any of you who want to go to the bathroom, to German Jews in America in the late 1800s and early 1900s, this distinctive ethnicity of Eastern European Jews was a threat. Difference was a danger to their hard-won freedoms. Their true freedom, they thought, would come with conformity and Americanization. And the irony of this, of course, is that the greatness of America, as we all know looking back on it today, and what made it distinct from the Europe that they had just fled from, right, was in its growing pluralism because of all these immigrant populations. Trying to force conformity often backfired by promoting prejudice, racism, and xenophobia. Today, as we all know, these ethnic distinctions that we've talked about today are pretty much gone. I would venture to guess that any family descended from Germans who came to this country in the early 1800s would not be very upset if their son came home today with a girl who was descended from Eastern European roots. In fact, most of our families, right, well now, I was just going to say, most of our families at this point have already mixed together. We have German roots, we have Eastern European roots. So these distinctions are gone, they've been blurred. Unfortunately, it would be nice to say that all distinctions amongst Jews and all conflicts because of these distinctions have also disappeared. But of course, they have been replaced by other distinctions and other conflicts. And in light of this discussion, my last message is that we need to keep in mind that the greatness of this country rests in the mutual respect for difference, diversity, and pluralism. Thank you very much.